I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is blogger and critic Maria Popova. She's joined in conversation by journalist Alexis Madrigal. And now, join Barbara Lane on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Maria Popova and Alexis Madrigal.
Maria Popova calls herself a curiosity architect. Her remarkable blog, Brain Pickings, launched as a passion project in 2006, has become an intellectual touchstone for inquiring minds that now draws several million readers a month. The New York Times says Brain Pickings combines the high-mindedness of a TED Talk with the pop sensibility of P.T. Barnum. It's a treasure chest full of pieces across art, design, science, technology, philosophy, history, politics, psychology, sociology, ecology, and anthropology, which Popova calls a human-powered discovery engine for interestingness. Brain Pickings has an eclectic group of devotees, including the novelist William Gibson, the singer Josh Groban, the comedian Drew Carey, the neuroscientist David Eagleman, actress Mia Farrow, and Twitter founders Biz Stone and Evan Williams. Here to pick Maria Popova's brain tonight is Alexis Madrigal, Fusion's editor-in-chief, former senior editor at The Atlantic and staff writer at Wired, and author of Powering the Dream. Please welcome them both to the JCCSF.
All right. We were just talking backstage. Actually, the hard thing about interview like this is that you've got people in the audience who are super fans, you know, who have read everything that's on Brain Pickings, all 5,000 posts, I'm sure. And then you have people who are just sort of being introduced to this human who just come to everything in this event series. So just to get everybody on the same page, why don't you just tell us, what's Brain Pickings to you? Like, how do you think about the mission of Brain Pickings, and how does it actually work? Because I think it's a very surprising media property.
So it's interesting because when I started it, and next year marks the 9th anniversary. So when I started, I would not have been able to answer that question in a coherent way. But today, I would say it's simply a record of my own effort to figure out how to live a meaningful, sensical, inspired life. And it's changed a lot with me. It's been a record of my own becoming in a way. So that is still what it is. But I think the reason why, perhaps why other people read it too, is that there is this element of what are these timeless but timely pieces of knowledge, wisdom, information, inspiration, radiance out in the world that really illuminate all of us when we encounter them.
But, like, you know, most people in their process of becoming don't end up, like, producing thousands of blog posts. what does it actually look like? Like, if someone were to go to Brain Pickings, like, what would they actually see there, for those who haven't been?
They would see a kind of museum of collective memory of ideas that matter, that are interesting and important from philosophy, science, art, and everything in between. That are kind of undergirded by this question of what does it mean to live a meaningful life? And it could be anything from, you know, the diaries of a Japanese court woman from the 8th century to Susan Sontag's diaries and Einstein and Aristotle and all the rest.
I think, like, you know, as a fellow writer and media person, maybe the most interesting thing about Brain Pickings to me is that it sort of is its own genre. Like, they're like a Brain Pickings post, of which, like, Maria writes 99% or 99.9%. They are this, their own thing. They're not really like a magazine blurb. They're certainly not like a news article. Like, how do you think about the genre of the Brain Pickings post? Like, what is it?
Well, I don't think it's particularly original or novel. I've always been very fascinated by these medieval manuscripts called Florilegia, which stands for the Latin for flower and gather. So the singular is Florilegium. And those were, monks would take passages from existing manuscripts and literally cut them and paste them together to better illuminate some doctrine or idea and kind of add their own interpretation of it. And they were the most lavish and beautiful books to produce. And at the time, only royalty could afford them. But this practice of making sense of something by taking existing ideas, changing or amplifying the context and clarifying it by combining, that's kind of the genre, but it's not new.
Or like a commonplace book, right?
A commonplace
like later
book,
on, like
yeah.
People like scrapbooking in a sense with their own annotations. What about more recent things? Like, what did you grow up reading, or when you were starting your site? Like, how did you think about what you were doing? What were your models for it?
Well, what's interesting is that when I started, I mean, I think brain picking started out of a profound place of dissatisfaction. I had just come to the U.S. for college from Bulgaria. I grew up in communist Bulgaria. By the time I was college age,
Philadelphia was disappointing to you as the seat of capitalism?
Well, yeah. Kind of, yes. I mean, interestingly, it is, I think, for people who don't go through that experience, perhaps don't fully realize how disorienting it is to go from the 99% of Bulgaria, which is significantly below the 99% of America, and come into the 1% of America. It's pretty, I mean, I went to Penn, pretty rich kid school, you know, and the culture that goes along with that was very strange and homeless-making to me in a way. And on top of that, I had bought into the promise of Ivy League liberal arts education, but I found myself in these, you know, 400-person lecture halls where somebody's reading off a PowerPoint and sending you home to memorize things and then standardize test you. And to me, I wasn't learning what I had gone to learn, which is how to live. And I was really unsettled and dissatisfied. I had to work four jobs to pay for that, unsatisfactory
experience. Right.
And so I ended up just, I guess a commonplace book is the best equivalent, keeping a record of what I was learning on my own, just going to the library or just, you know, there was internet back then, kept doing that. And one of the jobs that I was working was at this creative agency in Philly. There was seven guys, just young idealists, wanted to do things with brands changing the world. And I started this little newsletter within the office for inspiration for them. Because one thing I had noticed too, which was another kind of parallel concern, was that what they were circulating for inspiration within the office came from their own fields. It was all design, media, communication arts. And to me, that felt off and counterintuitive to how creativity should work, which is by taking all these disparate ideas and disciplines and eras and combining them. And so I started this newsletter that was five interesting things that I had read, come upon every week, that had nothing to do with that field. And that's how it started.
Huh. Did you learn then how to sort of make it interesting to people who, you know, had never heard of Susan Sontag?
Well, I hadn't heard of Susan Sontag. I knew nothing at the time. I think I was very much powered by this kind of beginner's mind because I was discovering all these things that I assumed all Americans always knew. It's just that at some point it kind of surpassed what ordinary people really knew, and I found myself doing this kind of obscure thing that I assumed was just common, you know, mainstream culture. But I never really thought about making it interesting. It's interesting. I get asked a lot, get emails and at Q&As and whatever, usually from young people saying, how do you do an interesting blog or a successful blog or a successful XYZ, whatever their thing is? And I always think, you know, the only way to be interesting is to be interested, and to be interested with consistency and doggedness. And you can't really kind of manufacture and engineer interestingness otherwise. And so I just kept reading and writing about what I thought was interesting to me, and it just kind of grew on its own.
And there is something about that experience. I mean, I grew up in rural Washington State in like a tiny town called Ridgefield, had 2,500 people, had like a mascot that was a very angry potato. It was like an incredibly rural, kind of crappy place to grow up. And, you know, went to school back east, and there was something about walking into one of those really big libraries and like going into the stacks, like not, you know, searching on Google Books, but like going into the stacks and seeing sometimes just, you know, like on the cart along the side, like all those books stacked up and like pulling one off and suddenly finding yourself
discovery.
Kind of fascinated by something that was just basically adjacent to, by accident, the thing that you were actually going to get for your paper that you didn't want to write. Did you have a moment within your time, you know, when you got to school or thereafter, where you got into that concept of sort of like archive digging or like going to the paper source and like bringing it into this digital world?
Not in a literal sense, but I definitely had that experience of, so let me backtrack and just say that the internet is really good at giving us what we know we're interested in. It is a search-oriented culture. It is really terrible at giving us that moment of discovery of that island in the Pacific Southwest that I didn't know existed in their, you know, pottery or whatever it is. And in a way, while I was in college, in addition to the course load and the four jobs, I had an internship for Stephen Fried, who's an amazing nonfiction writer. And at the time, he was working on a book about Fred Harvey, who was the man that started the restaurant industry in America. And it grew out of the Southwest railroad networks. So, and that was in the kind of mid-1800s, early 1800s. And in order to do research on that time period, you had to go read microfilm on a reel,
right.
A microfilm being, for the younger people, your scans of newspapers on this roll on a projector, and the
you scroll through this dial,
and it's this like ugly, basically a glorified, not a sub-glorified PDF.
Yes, right. Worse than a PDF, which is like the worst thing you can be. Yeah.
But what struck me, and I spent hours upon hours at the microfilm machine looking for specific things that we wanted to know about him, and if any mention of him in the paper. But in the process of that, because there is no keyword search, there's no search, there's just discovery, you would come upon the most extraordinary, unexpected, you know, the little fights between the two editors of the competing papers, like the cleverest humor you'll ever read, or really funny ads for things, and or wanted things for, like, somebody lost a silver spoon on a date, and they want to find the lady, though. I mean, it's, like, crazy stuff. And I had this sense of, you know, there is so much of, so much beauty and so much truthful human experience that is out there recorded in the world that we are not finding, that is being forgotten because there is no search for it. There's only discovery. And in a way, today, brain pickings is kind of like a microfilm reader for the past.
Huh, that's interesting. If you want to have this experience that she's describing and you don't want to go to the microfiche reader, you can go to Chronicling America, which is this library. I mean, I'm doubtless seen this Library of Congress site. They scanned a bunch of papers from like the late 19th century into the early 20th, and that you can go actually see them in their original form, front pages, ads, and all. And it's like it's a pretty remarkable experience, I think, to see the adjacencies that are
Google Books now actually also carries a lot of newspapers from a century ago that you can look for the titles, and you can look at like PDF versions of them.
Before we get back to brain pickings, I want to touch on sort of something that you said, which was sort of both the disorientation of coming from Bulgaria, but also like now that you're here, now you're established. Like, what's your relationship to Bulgaria now, and say Bulgarian media? Do you have like a Bulgarian brain pickings where you're like going through the country's history, like pulling?
I have sadly no relationship. It's a past life.
Huh. Wow. Yeah.
My family lives there, and I go once a year, but I know nothing about the ecosystem of culture and politics and things like that.
Do they know what brain pickings has become within the United States?
Well, I think so, because I hear from Bulgarian media frequently.
Huh. But I mean your parents.
Oh, my parents?
Yeah.
I mean, I think they do their best to understand. My mother was actually trained in library science. She never did anything with her degree. She went into computers. But I think on some level, she feels a kinship because there's a librarian-esque component to what I do. And my dad is a computer programmer, so he kind of gets the kind of technical aspect of this thing on the internet that has XYZ.
He wants to talk about your CMS. He's like, let's talk about the code that powers your site. So, you know, one thing I find fascinating about Brain Pickings, again, like thinking about it as media, is that a lot of what Facebook pages do to the world, and like Facebook does the world, is it the literal algorithm says, like, you like these things, we're going to serve you more of these things. Mm-hmm. And the way that you were describing Brain Pickings earlier was this sort of as this machine that surprises you, essentially, by not playing into the filter bubble that you're in. But one thing that's interesting is I was thinking, like, Brain Pickings does, in fact, have a huge following on Facebook. So how do you actually get what you want people to read, like, these surprising things, through that algorithm which says, like, oh, this person may not, doesn't want to be surprised? I mean, that's essentially what the Facebook algorithm says, is, like, I will never surprise you. You will see only things that you engage with already, right?
I mean, I will say that I think I'm a pretty optimistic person. If I spend time and thought on Facebook, I become a cynical, mean pessimist. And so I try not to. It is really depressing for those very reasons, that there is this machine out there that is basically in charge of telling people what matters in the world and why and what they should pay attention to. And so it's really strange to me to observe. I mean, there are about 4 million people on the Brain Pickings page on Facebook, which is a pretty large sample pool to kind of observe as a sociological experiment. And I actually think Brain Pickings is very much a filter bubble. I mean, the JCC is a filter bubble. Every public radio station is a filter bubble. There's a huge self-selection component to us here, and everybody listening to this, and everybody reading me or reading you, there is a huge filter bubble. But what's interesting about Facebook is that 4 million is a sample much wider than that bubble in real time, meaning there's going to be a lot of people who... So, for example, on Tuesday, it was National Coming Out Day, and so I had written some months ago about these really wonderful, I think 7 or so, children's books that help kids figure out gender and identity and all of that. And so for the Coming Out Day, I posted on Facebook... All of a sudden, the Mad Hatter Tea Party people came out of the woodwork, and you know, just it became this.
And you were like, "You like so Brain Pickings? Have you learned nothing from this site?"
Yeah. That's the perplexing thing. Like, why are they on that page? Yeah. Given our values are night and day, and they're on that page because some dumb algorithm thought that it was appropriate. So we have transcended human judgment and we're letting machines do that. It's kind of...
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned children's books, which is oddly something I know from... Maria and I know each other. And I know from personal experience that you love children's books.
I do.
And I think it's like a very interesting thing. Like, what attracts you to children's books as a genre?
Well, first of all, I don't think there is such a thing as children's books. Tolkien wrote about this, C.S. Lewis wrote about this, Neil Gaiman talks about this all the time. There is no such thing as writing for children as a separate species. Great children's books are really wonderful books that are allegories of much bigger subjects. And so I think sometimes simplicity of language and image can deliver really complex points by disarming our defenses against them in a way that an elaborate, you know, overwrought thing would not. The other thing, too, is that I grew up behind the Iron Curtain, so I didn't really get children's books. I mean, I had, like, the real original gory Brothers Grimm fairy tales. I had Alice in Wonderland, which to this day is my favorite book, and The Little Prince, which I also love, but very limited, you know. I discovered Maurice Sendak as an adult. All these amazing people, everybody under Ursula Nordstrom. If you guys don't know Ursula Nordstrom, she is a cultural hero. She was the legendary Harper and Row children's book editor who basically nursed Sendak from an insecure artist to a genius. She also she discovered, you know, E.B. White, all these people, like Goodnight Moon, Charlotte's Web, Where the Wild Things Are, almost every beloved mid-century children's book, she was the power and the spiritual sustenance behind. And so I didn't benefit from any of that, but coming into it as an adult and looking at these works that have so much subtlety and so much beauty and so much truth in them, it's kind of an extraordinary thing.
You're listening to blogger and critic Maria Popova, known for her blog Brain Pickings. She's joined in conversation by journalist Alexis Madrigal on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Who is your favorite children's book author? I mean, well, books that we call children's books, since they, yeah.
Ruth Krauss.
Huh. And what's she, what are her...
She collaborated with Sendak a lot before he became super famous. She has this kind of wry, witty way of exploring relationships and humanity and everything. There's a lovely book called Open House for Butterflies, which Sendak illustrated. And there's another one called I'll Be You and You Be Me, which is kind of this love letter to friendship. And she has a lot more. Just look her up. Ruth Krauss, I really recommend her. And other than that, you know, Lewis Carroll, but his stuff is not even children's, even by people who believe in children's books.
Right. I think for me, it's Margaret Wise Brown's lesser-known books, right? I mean, it's like Good Night Moon. Mm. Everybody knows this book, of course. It's like one of the most famous children's books. But there's a book by her called The Quiet, Noisy Book, which is just...
Oh, I didn't know that.
It is so... Actually, my wife and I, we've been trying to get Harper to republish it for a long time because there's a crazy book all about the history of noise. It's like 900 pages, and it's insane. And the guy essentially mentions that he was touched by the fever to write this book by reading The Quiet, Noisy Book, this Margaret Wise Brown book. And when you read it, it asks you to listen for sounds that you almost can't hear, right? Like the flies opening their eyes, the birds opening their mouths to crow, a slow fig ripening for the Bay Area audience, right? All of these sounds that like are really make you reconsider what sound is and how your ears work.
Well, a lot of the great children's books are invitations to presence in one form or another that are very sensory, very much an embodied experience in some way.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing has made me happier than our little son saying, "That's a skyscraper scraping the sky," which is one of her things. Let's talk a little bit about your research process. I mean, just like, how do you... Let's start with the example that you gave. Like, how do you end up finding your way through all these interests to this editor who is responsible for these things and gives people this sort of, like, knowledge behind the knowledge?
It's a combination of search and discovery. A lot of it is semi-serendipitous in the sense of, you know, I always say that literature is the original internet, and you know, I discover, you know, in every book there's a footnote, there's an allusion, there's a reference that's actually a hyperlink to another work. And so in, what was I reading? I must have been reading one of the Ruth Krauss books, and I wanted to find out the story of how she got to collaborate with Sendak, came upon Ursula Nordstrom's letters, which are amazing. It's a book called Dear Genius, compiled by Leonard Marcus, who's a children's book historian. And her letters, this woman, this amazing spirit, I found how, like, she was basically a shrink to Sendak. She was his friend and confidant and defender and psychiatrist and dating counselor, like, everything. But in those letters, they would refer to some other thing that leads you to another book, and then, you know, and then I'm suddenly a person who likes vintage children's books, and I'm sitting here with you, and you're telling me about the Little Quiet Book, and I say, oh, I didn't know about that.
Quiet,
and then
noisy
I go,
book.
Quiet, noisy book. And then I go home, and I look that up, and I get that. Right. So that chain of self-selection, but kind of deliberate, kind of serendipitous, you know, that's how it is.
That's really interesting. And what about, like, the actual, you know, operations of it? Like, do you just have... you know, like a Word document with like 100 story ideas on it right now?
I do have an Evernote file that is kind of this revolving, when I would come upon something and just have something else planned for the next few days, so I would put in this file as a later use. I'm embarrassed to say a compulsive book buyer. And the funny and tragic thing is that even though I donate to the New York Public Library every single month, and I support them in other ways too, and I love them, I've not been able to get a library card because of my citizenship status for years. So I either have to borrow people's cards, like friends' cards, or it just becomes too big a hassle, so I find some 4-cent used paperback to buy online, you know, because
right.
It's easier. And it's not ideal. But I get a lot of books, and they are my number one space and money expense in life.
So, speaking of money, how do you support yourself doing brain pickings? Like, what is the model that?
It's donations. It's primarily donations, very similar to public radio, I would say. So it's all free, but people donate, and either as a one time or a lot of people subscribe, and it's a monthly thing.
Wow.
Yeah, and I also, you know, it's interesting to observe how things change. So I, like almost every website that links to Amazon, have a percentage of books. If people buy a book from Amazon from my site, I get a percentage. And, you know, the New York Review of Books does that, the Millions does that, everybody does that. And for a while, that was kind of even with the donations. In the last, I would say, 3 or 4 years, it's become so much smaller. The donations have become the primary thing, which is kind of heartening because
you get to just serve those people.
Yeah, I mean, right. In a way, I mean, they know, I say on the site, if you buy from Amazon, it helps me. So sometimes right. People would write me and say, can I, like, buy more things? Does that help you? Like, they know that that's also a way of supporting.
Right.
But the caveat, too, is that for every book that I write about, I also provide a public library link. So I encourage people to actually go to the library. So maybe I don't encourage that as much as people who don't provide public library links, but it's been really wonderful to watch this kind of genuine goodwill grow the way that, I mean, I write about what I want to read about. I have the thing that I want to exist. I personally donate to things all the time, so it's so lovely to see that the self-selection again, you know, people are doing that in turn.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think of brain pickings as, you know, sort of one of the models for what, like, a blog could be, like, what it could evolve into. But what most of the blogs that came up, they're just all gone, you know?
Yeah.
There's, like, Kotke is still around. But other than that, you know, this whole generation of people that I feel like I came up with as a writer who were sort of rebelling against the restrictions of essentially print media, we sort of got to the end of it, and it was like, oh, wait, actually, now we just have to go work for the websites of the print media companies, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's what happened to most people. And then, like, brain pickings, like, remained this kind of singular media property that is just it's like the world's most, you know, best blog left,
yeah.
You know? It's like an amazing thing.
Hardly, but thank you.
I just think, do you consider expanding it? I mean, I'm sure you must get offers like this all the time to do like a brain pickings podcast or a brain pickings like live event series or like just a brain pickings TV show, like all of these sort of extensions of what you're doing.
I do think about them. I would love to have, radio is my favorite medium by far. I would love to have a podcast or a radio show at some point. However, what I do takes me every waking moment of my day. You know, being here tonight is taking time away from reading and writing, all of that. And I think it's, we get so distracted by what seems like an exciting or prestigious or, you know, thrilling thing to do from the outside, but from the inside, we sometimes forget what is the thing that actually most nourishes us and feels like when you go to sleep at night, that's been a full day. Yeah. And for me, reading and writing is it. So if I were to do something else, it would have to take away from that. And of course, I might be different in another 9 years. Maybe radio would be the thing for me. Maybe it would be some other thing that doesn't even exist yet. But I will footnote that also by saying that your observation about why a whole generation of web writers and bloggers and people who did that are kind of scattering and going away, I think it actually has a lot to do with the disillusionment that comes from having to work in an ad-supported ecosystem, which is profoundly depressing. And one thing that has been probably the only really deliberate decision that I've made all these years is to not deal with advertising. I've just refused to have advertising because I, as a reader, when I am on the internet, I hate it. I hate it. You know, and why would I create something that I hate?
I bet you're the only one. I bet everyone in the audience loves advertising. They're just like, where can I get some more advertising on my internet? That's what they want.
But I do think it helps, and I don't mean that as a kind of holier-than-thou thing. I mean it as a spiritual sustenance thing. I think it's helped me stay less, not,
right.
Facebook
you
is
haven't
a good
chased
example.
Just large audience. Yeah. You've gotten to serve the people who actually want to read what
or
you
want to put. Or not serve my own sanity. Like the effect that Facebook has on me, the cynical, pessimistic Grumpelstein, you know, that is what ad-supported media and having to deal with those metrics and seeing constantly how many people are looking at this and how is this translating into my CPM or whatever they talk about in those meetings.
So you don't look at analytics for your site?
No. I used to because WordPress gives you the analytics right up front.
Yeah.
And then I realized it's so toxic and so I disabled it. So now I don't want to look at it. And before
you don't have to work in it.
So before I knew that you could disable it on WordPress, I actually put a piece of duct tape on my screen where it shows up.
Wow.
Because I couldn't take it.
It does. It drives people a little crazy. It does drive people a little crazy. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting though. The problem, of course, is that most things do not have a precisely defined enough audience, and they can spend 5 or 6 years building it up in order to charge people money for it. Right? I mean, this is like the problem. That's depressing. Let's move on to something else. So let's talk about this. You have talked about Brain Pickings as, you know, your chronicle of an intellectual and emotional journey through life. So how does your personal life end up influencing Brain Pickings, right? If it's your journey, how does that show up in what you're writing about?
Well, it's interesting. I have this kind of dual self-delusion where on the one hand I think, you know, there's no line between work and life for me. It's all one. And on the other hand, I think, of course nobody knows what's going on in my life just from what I write about. I mean, I know. And then in the last week, what's interesting is that I have gotten a number of emails from different readers, one saying, this could be an odd question, but I wonder if you've lost somebody in your life recently. And the other saying, this could be an odd question, but I wonder if you've just had either your heart broken or have fallen in love. And the answer to all of these questions with varying degrees of literalness is yes, you know. And it's so extraordinary that people can intuit. But I will say, we as humans attune ourselves to certain wavelengths based on what's going on in our lives. So the first woman that wrote me had also mentioned that she had just lost her brother at a young age, completely unexpectedly. Clearly, she was in a mindset able to pick up on these kind of little threads of destiny and, you know, just spiritual disposition that we carry. And the other woman said that she had gotten back together with somebody after 25 years. So clearly, you know, loss and longing and reunion and all these things have been on her mind, which is all to say we are never as untransparent as we believe we are.
Right. But do you think that, can you look back on eras of your life? Like if we were to show you a random Brain Pickings post, right? Could you say like, oh, well, that's, I got interested in that because of X and Y factors in my life? Or is it more like, or not even in your life, but just like what you were processing in your mind, like what you were trying to think about as a meaningful life? I don't even mean life events, but just sort of your own intellectual journey. Can you pinpoint those things in that way?
Yes and no. I think because it deals with things that are kind of timeless, there's an element of this is as valid for me now as it was 5 years ago. But there's also an element of what parts of this book that I pick up on 5 years ago that are different from what I picked up on now, and which is why I would often revisit books, actually very frequently, books that are, you know, I would write about the diaries of Henry David Thoreau once every few months because I would come to them with a different disposition and would get out of them a different thing. Because just like those readers who emailed me, we bring our lives to everything we engage with, right, and we get out of it something that mirrors back that stuff to us.
Yeah. The writing and researching for What Post do you think changed you the most?
Oh, that's a hard one. I have to think about that. I mean, everything changes me. Everything, you know, it's...
But, like, was there one that you particularly felt?
At different times, there are different things. There have been things that have moved me very palpably. More recently, I guess, I read about Adam Phillips, who's a psychoanalyst, beautiful writer. I think he's kind of the Carl Jung of our time. And he has a book about called Missing Out in Praise of the Unlived Life, I believe, which is a beautiful work.
Go on.
Of Well, yeah. He talks about how right now we're sitting here accompanied by all the ghosts of the versions of ourselves that didn't manifest because we failed at them or because we chose away from them or for whatever reason. And all the lives we chose to live are a product of the lives we chose not to live. And of course, there are so many elements that speak to contemporary culture and the whole FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out and what is that about and what does this play into? But his whole point is that the frustration of having missed out on something actually amplifies the satisfaction of what you chose ultimately. And
like your own life among the counterfactuals actually looks better than your own life without
it. Doesn't
them.
Always look better, but
richer.
Even in it's richer for the disappointment of not having had these other things too.
Huh. Because you've chosen it. Yeah. That's interesting. I want to talk about so you're coming up on your 9-year anniversary. At your 7-year anniversary, you had a post that was about the 7 learnings that you got. So it's been 2 more years. And I just want to, for the edification of the audience, I'm going to run through the 7, and I want you to tell me if you still agree or disagree with these lessons.
All right.
Allow yourself the uncomfortable luxury of changing your mind.
Oh, absolutely.
Still agree.
Yeah.
Okay. Do nothing for prestige or status or money or approval alone.
I'm going to tell you right now, I agree with all of them.
Okay, I won't keep that. But what if it was a lot of money? What if it was
those?
Like a lot of money? That wouldn't change anything. Then I'll just keep running through them. And you can comment on, at the end of them, how it sounds. To
all right.
Be generous. Build pockets of stillness into your life. And that one also had another bolded word in the entry, which was sleep. When people try to tell you who you are, don't believe them. Presence is far...
Well, that's the... I think you need to read it in full in order to get the context of that.
Well, give us the context for
it. Well, no, it's the whole thing. I mean, it was Maya Angelou who said, when people tell you who they are, believe them. But I think the opposite is also true. When people try to tell you who you are, don't believe them, because what they think about you says more about them than it does about you.
Right.
So trust your own motives and trust your own integrity and don't kind of buy into either the praise or the hate or whatever it is.
Presence is far more intricate and rewarding in art than productivity. I wanted to ask you about this one in particular because you are one of the most productive people I've ever met. I also fall into this category, and so I don't think I follow Rule 6 here. What do you mean by that? And is it possible to just you must believe on the basis of this that it's possibly present and productive?
It is possible. Frederick Douglass had this idea. He talked about aesthetic force, which is an experience that we have when we encounter something that transforms us. In the act of engaging with it. So a symphony, a poem, a sunset, in the course of that experience, it's aesthetic force that really changes us. About a century later, Susan Sontag wrote in On Photography, which is one of the greatest books of all time, about what she called aesthetic consumerism, which is our tendency to reduce the experience to an object. So for instance, by photographing a moment as opposed to living it and making it this packageable, shareable, marketable commodity. And I think one of the dangers in our culture, perhaps one of the greatest dangers, is that we have come to mistake the aesthetic experience for the aesthetic object. And so even, you know, us driving here on the bridge, stuck in traffic, and looking at a beautiful sunset, and I told you I had this kind of conflicted impulse. I do want to take a photograph of the sunset, but I also want to not, because I want to watch the sunset. And the presence and productivity is very much about finding out for yourself which part feeds which, the aesthetic force or the aesthetic consumerism. And I think it's a discipline to do the one that is the one that's truly rewarding, the one that changes you.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features blogger and critic Maria Popova, known for her blog Brain Pickings. She's joined in conversation by journalist Alexis Madrigal. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, and you know, I think my response as someone who takes like lots and lots of photographs with, you know, mostly with like a big camera, is just like, I actually think framing shots helps you see. It helps you actually look at the sunset in a way that's more powerful than just kind of going, oh, look at, that's pretty.
If you do it for yourself, yes. But if you do it in order to share, in order to get, like, the productivity thing is, if you're saying, well, I need to put out 20 photos today in order for this date to count, then we're trekking into a then it's no longer about seeing, then it's about being seen as a seer.
Yeah. But what, I mean, how do you reconcile that with your drive to work?
I don't think it needs reconciliation. I think one feeds the other. Both spring from an impulse for aliveness. And it's aliveness that makes you want to get up in the morning and be thrilled to read and write and do whatever you're doing. And it's also aliveness that makes you want to put the phone down and sit in the car and watch the sky and just see how that feels.
Right. This one is actually a quote, "Expect anything worthwhile to take a long time."
That's by Debbie Millman. No, I completely agree.
I want to talk about a couple last things about, you know, what fascinations of brain pickings. Who are the stars of the brain pickings world? I mean, you know, you've mentioned Susan Sontag. I would say Margaret Mead for my own reading is also, but also like Nietzsche. And the question is, who do you think among the people that you seem to come back to doesn't fit with the rest? Is there anyone that is sort of like outside of the brain pickings universe of or constellation of stars that you feel like for some reason you keep coming back to?
Well, one of the things that keeps it interesting for me over, you know, 9 years is that I feel like there is no kind of stereotype or archetype of person, and that there's very little that you can, you know, tie between Mary Oliver and Nietzsche, you know.
Right.
and those are both people that I enjoy tremendously in different doses and at different times. I do for my own, and it's perhaps that's just kind of a spiritual survival strategy, but when I feel drained or down or circling the drain of burnout, because I do too, like everybody, there are certain things that I turn to that I know will restore my sense of vitality. And, you know, so one would be Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. I can read that all day, every day. It's kind of like a drug. Mm-hmm. Another is, you know...
And when you get too happy, you just, like, pull out...
and then I pull out the Kierkegaard and it's
right.
All done.
I want to close with something that you have been sort of grappling with on the site right now. And I think it's something that many people are grappling with, which is essentially the racial politics of our time relative to the narrative that we have about progress. And I thought maybe you could just talk a little bit about a conversation that you have devoted a lot of time to between James Baldwin and Margaret Mead, and like why that particular conversation has felt, you know, with your own particular interest right now to be important.
Yeah, so in August of 1970, Margaret Mead and James Baldwin met on a public stage. They had never met before. And they, between Friday evening and Sunday afternoon, they had a total of 7 hours of conversation broken up into three segments. And it was eventually published as this book called A Rap on Race, which devastatingly is out of print, which is absurd.
And surprisingly,
I mean, it's
completely
hard to find,
absurd. Actually,
yeah. It is hard to find. There's you know, black market for this book on eBay and Amazon that you can buy it for hundreds of dollars. And I came upon it by complete chance through a footnote in one of Margaret Mead's. So she published a column in Redbook for many years, where her partner was editor, and the column was eventually published as this other book called Some Personal Views. And in a footnote in that other book, she mentions meeting James Baldwin, and I thought, that would be interesting. Let's find that. So I found that book, and I found it right after Ferguson. So imagine reading that. And that conversation is, they get to things that we have trouble getting to today that are just as relevant, and heartbreakingly so, that we've made so little progress. But what makes it so special is that it's an actual conversation. It is a dialogue. It is not this kind of cross spitfire of reactivity and self-righteousness that passes for conversation today, in most, especially on the internet. And to see two of the most extraordinary minds of their time come and tackle a problem that is enormous and do it with enormous mutual respect and dignity and consideration and reflection and contemplation and things that we have forgotten how to do, it's something else.
What did you take away from it? I mean, not to ask you to overly capsulize what obviously was a fascinating and multifaceted conversation, but like, what do they get to that we don't get to now?
They get to so many of the substrata of the so-called race issue, which is actually so many different issues, including, you know, the very structure of America, why the whole notion of the melting pot is a hugely problematic metaphor. They talk about immigration. They talk about, you know, at one point, Baldwin says, we have to be optimistic about human beings because that's all we have. And he's speaking from a place of enormous trauma and enormous disappointment in human beings. And by that point, he's older, much older than, well, not much older. They're around the same age. They're around 70. So Margaret Mead is 70. He's in his 60s. They're both kind of a little curmudgeonly, you know. It's actually kind of funny when at some point Margaret Mead disagrees with him, and her kind of sound of disagreement is she yells, "Oh, fiddlesticks," which is my new put down. It's not even a put down. It's kind of like this.
It's an exclamation.
Oh, fiddlesticks. But so he, in the midst of being really kind of unsettled by so much of what he's observing, he talks about his 12-year-old nephew growing up. And the other thing, too, is he was a gay man in mid-century America, pre-civil rights, coming of age. She was a queer woman at the same time, on the precipice of the women's liberation movement. This book, the conversation took place in 1970, so just shortly after the feminine mystique and all of that. So both of them have these enormous areas of unprivileged, you know, swimming against the stream.
And some commonalities.
And some commonalities. I mean, I would not do it justice. I just must say, try to find that book. Go to the library. Borrow a friend's card if you're in a citizenship situation like myself.
And failing that, you can see the posts on Brain Pickings. Let's take some questions from the audience.
Okay.
There's going to be...
So just put your hand up, and we'll start right here in the front.
Hi. My question is, what unintentional, unintended byproduct or collaboration or partnership has come from Brain Pickings? I mean, one of my favorites is Wendy McNaughton, the work that she's done with you.
Woo!
But, Wendy!
I love her. But and you, obviously. But yeah, if you could share.
I mean, that goes back to the no line between life and work. I love doing things with people I like, people that are smart and kind and creative and generous. And Wendy has actually become perhaps my closest friend through the course of these years and years of collaborations. And, you know, I met my partner through Brain Pickings. Things that are, you cannot plan for them, but they come from that cross-pollination of life and work or self and self in the world.
Hi. I think in your discovery kind of what does it mean to live a meaningful life, I think many of us, at least myself in the reading, it's also your process kind of unfolds mine. And my question to you is that you said that like you were at Penn and there was this large dissatisfaction. That's kind of what led you to create Brain Pickings. Does the dissatisfaction, like, does it ever dissolve? Has it evolved? Or is it still kind of an underlying force which motivates you to keep looking?
I think a certain degree of dissatisfaction is necessary for any kind of creative work. I call it creative restlessness. Without that, you're not really compelled to do anything. But I also firmly believe that we pull ourselves out of our own holes by our own bootstraps, and there's nobody else that would do that for us. And for me, Brain Pickings has been very much that, and every day it's that.
It's been said for many years that Anonymous was a woman, and for at least 6 or 7 of years of your Brain Pickings, you were anonymous.
That's not true.
Well, but it was anonymous in the sense that, you know, when we first read it, we were like, who's writing this, male, female, where is it coming? And it wasn't well known who you were or anything about you. And I'm just curious about before and after and some of the choices you made around that. Because for me as a first-time reader, it was anonymous for a long time. And then it became not anonymous at some point, when, especially after the New York Times started writing about you. But
well, my byline has been on every single article I've ever written since day one. I think we often mistake our own lack of knowledge for another person's secret. That's all I'm going to say about that.
But there was, I mean, I think there's a point to it in that. I do think that in going to Brain Pickings in the early days, you weren't like front and center. Like a lot of people would have just like had their like picture like right there, like sort of like, this is who it is. This is sort of the identity politics you should be perceiving around this post. This is like, you know.
I mean, I guess more than anonymity, it was really a matter, and I still feel this to this day, of giving voice to the things that I highlight, the writers, thinkers, ideas, books, whatever it is, and it's not really about me. Even if a faction of my readers can tell what's going on in my personal life from it, you know, but it really is about celebrating these sources of meaning and creating this kind of, like I said, like a museum of meaning that is personal, that comes from a personal place. I mean, so one very good example, Andrew Sullivan. How many of you guys know Andrew Sullivan? Yeah. A lot of people, amazing journalist, writer, who for many years ran a website called The Dish, which had various iterations elsewhere. And he would point to pieces of news, usually commentary from other websites, and very short lines of his and just a selection of quoted things. Now, it is other people's ideas in a way, but if you read him, in just a few days, you knew very clearly who Andrew Sullivan was, what he stood for, what he believed in, and who his person was, his identity. So I think anonymity is a very different thing from impersonality. I mean, there's a different thing going on. You can be very personal without being exhibitionist in your persona.
Yeah. For sure.
You know, I'm really struck by what feels to me like a tone of kindness on your part, just in the tone of how you're writing to people.
Thank you.
As though you're very understanding, like, hey, we're both in this human predicament, and it's very confusing, and sometimes it hurts. And here is a random piece of knowledge that might give you some grounding or a story that'll help you to understand what you've you know, been thrust into in some way. And one of the things that really got me addicted to reading your posts was this idea, which I call like the noble dilettante, right? Like everything in our culture is relentlessly, aggressively calibrated, right, to develop expertise. The narrower, the better, right? If you have deep, narrow expertise, you get a Nobel Prize, everybody, you're a hero, you're a demigod, right? And there's almost nowhere for people who have maybe like me been through a liberal arts college and are profoundly interested in absolutely everything. And that's how you seem to me. You seem to be somebody who's deeply interested in so many different things that there's just no time to develop that narrow, deep expertise. I was wondering if you could talk to that a little bit about sort of that idea of, you know, it's pejorative, right, to call someone a dilettante, but for me, you make it noble.
Thank you. I like the term generalist perhaps a little bit better than dilettante. You know, Buckminster Fuller wrote about this 40 years ago. He wrote against specialization and how it's really kind of drowning intellectual and creative life, especially in America. I don't think it's a matter of lack of time to go specialize. I think it's a purposeful choice. I think today we often confuse genius and competence. You know, Krista Tippett, who hosts a wonderful public radio show called On Being, which I highly recommend, she talks about this notion of spiritual genius, which touches on this question of kindness. I think genius in the sense of, and the word genius has medieval origins, it has divine connotations. The people that I most admire have that quality of expansive, far-reaching, kind way of presenting whatever the knowledge they have is, whether it's general or specific. And to me, the most compelling knowledge, the real genius, is delivered with radiance and in the language of enthusiasm. And that's not something that our culture necessarily encourages. So I guess I see value in trying to do that a little bit.
If I can add 10 seconds to that, I mean, I don't know if anyone has run across the work of a guy named Tetlock, who used to be at Berkeley, and I think now he's
what
actually
is his
at
name?
Penn. Tetlock is his last name, and he wrote a book called The Fox and the Hedgehog, which is all about who's better at predicting quantifiable outcomes in the future, people who know a lot about one thing, or who are the hedgehogs, or people who know a lot of things, but only little about lots of stuff. And in these sort of prediction games that he asks these people to play about the real world, like the foxes win is the basic question. So there may actually be quantifiable value to being a fox rather than a hedgehog.
Okay.
In addition to radiance and beauty in the world.
Well, I have to say this has been one of the more stimulating evenings I've witnessed in a really long time. So thanks to you all for being here. Most of all, Alexis and Maria,
thank you
so very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was blogger and critic Maria Popova, known for her blog Brain Pickings. She was joined in conversation by journalist Alexis Madrigal. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio. And the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.